These are the stories that you need to know about today. A new European country has turned on the EU. Who is it this time? We're going to tell you. How Europe's elite's hatred of Russia, hatred, obsession with hatred of Russia, may be destroying not Russia, but them. I'm going to show you where and how it's happening. And President Donald Trump piles on. Did you hear this? In cold and very clear terms, he lays out his feelings for both the EU and Zelensky. And the short version, in case you didn't hear it, is he's done with both of them. Done. It's time for the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, there's a gathering storm against Europe's elites tonight. Prime ministers, party officials, citizens and leaders and countries throughout Europe are pushing back, standing up to these bankers and these lawyers and these war profiteers who are running Europe's administrative state. It's an administrative state, by the way, almost like a kind of like a government within a government. That's kind of what it is. It's a government within a government that actually runs the European Union and NATO. And here's something that is important to keep in mind as we talk about this, as we go through this conversation, you and I. Many of these people that I'm referring to do not have to answer to anybody, and certainly not to citizens, because they're appointed. They're appointed, in fact, anointed, some would argue. They're not elected. Now, this was a big part of my exclusive conversation with EU member Hungary's foreign minister yesterday. You find yourself in an environment here in Moscow, of all places, where it seems like there's an expectation of you as a European that you're supposed to hate the Russians. Don't you find that a little troublesome?
Oh, I do find it very troublesome. But, you know, my strategy is not to take care of these expectations. And what I hate is when my foreign policy strategy is being categorized pro-Russian, pro-American, No. It's a pro-Hungarian foreign policy. When it comes to Madame von der Leyen, I think that she caused so much harm to Europe that very few others. Under her leadership, Europe became a much less safe place than it used to be, much less competitive place as it used to be. And you know, the corruption which is there in Brussels is an explanation why Brussels has not raised the issue of the corruption in Kiev. And when it comes to Madame Kallas, you know, I think if you cannot disassociate yourself from your personal hatred, personal feelings against certain nations, that you cannot be neither a good foreign minister nor a good high representative.
He's talking about Kaja Kallas's hatred. Let's talk for a moment about this hatred. Not just Kaja Kallas's, but the hatred directed at Russia by most European elites. You know, it's the damnedest thing. As an American, I got to tell you, I didn't really know so much about this. I've never seen anything like it. I'm not sure I've ever seen or experienced hate like the hate that I feel coming from the Europeans toward my friends in Russia. You know, most of us learn from our moral teachings as children, and then later it's confirmed as we, you know, as we get older and as we experience life, we learn that when you're obsessed with hate, when we're obsessed with hating someone, we don't destroy them. You destroy yourself. When you hate somebody, it hurts you, not them. That's the way hatred works. So I can't help but wonder, I can't help but ask, is this what's happening right now with Europe's ruling elite? Let me give you a taste of what they sound like every day for the last 10 years.
It is time to shift to a wartime mindset.
Russia is becoming more and more of a threat to NATO.
This is a heavily militarized country that presents an existential threat to us all.
We urgently have to rearm Europe.
Supporting Ukraine is a bargain compared to the cost of Russia's victory.
In order to protect peace, we need to ramp up our material defense readiness.
The Russian economy is weakened, but our analysis is that the Russian economy can sustain the war at least for another year. So we have to sustain those sanctions.
I still think that, the effect should be felt by the Russian population as well.
We have put in place the strongest sanctions ever, which leave the Russian economy facing a decade of regression and its industry starved of any modern and critical technologies.
Can you believe this? We've got to destroy Russia. We've got to hurt Russia. We've got to sanction Russia. We have to go after Russia. Russia is bad. Russia, 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 Russia. It's like, this is the language of obsession. For more than a decade now, NATO, the EU, and the pre-Trump Washington crowd have been obsessed with Russia's destruction. It's like they're angry. It's the weirdest thing. And they said so and said so and said so. They want to collapse the economy of Russia to create chaos and breadlines for Russians. They want regime change to bring Vladimir Putin to his knees. And oh, they tried. They've tried. But it's like the old adage says, like my mom, your mom, maybe taught us, instead of destruction, Russia's economy has grown. President Putin enjoys an approval rating most of these people wish they could even come close to, more than 80%. Meanwhile, Russia's military appears stronger, bigger, certainly more technologically advanced because of the experiences in Ukraine. And they're more experienced now than ever before. So I have to ask, how's that hate thing going? How's that hate thing going? Let's start by checking in on France. That's a good place to start. Emmanuel Macron has repeatedly threatened send troops to war with Russia. Has the tough talk worked? No. His approval ratings are consistently between 11. Yes, that's the word coming out of my mouth. 11, or the number. 11 and 16%. That's how many people in France like this guy. Check for yourself. Google it. Check me. Make sure I got the right numbers. Google it. And then check to see how his opponents are doing these days. Here's a headline. Jordan Bardella leads the 2027 French presidential poll with record support. He's garnering between 35 and 37.5% of the vote among French voters. In case you don't know, who is Jordan Bardella? He's a candidate whose positions on Ukraine are the polar opposite of those of Macron. What do you think of that? He's against sending troops there. He opposes the sales of long-range missiles that can be used against Russia. He thinks it's stupid. He rejects NATO membership of Ukraine. Everything the opposite of what Macron says. Oh, and he calls for negotiating a peace deal with Russia to end the war with Ukraine. The numbers tell the story. Bardella's polling at 35 to 37%, 37.5 to be exact. Macron's polling at 11 to 16%. Duh. Let's go to Germany. Same thing. And these are the scenes there just in the last couple of days. Look at this video. That's crazy. Massive protests in Berlin. This is the future of Germany. This is its youth. Look at the faces. They're all young people. Tens of thousands of them taking to the streets to protest the pro-war government of Friedrich Merz. And what is it about Merz that they don't like? Apparently, his constant drumbeat for war with Russia, his demand to continually send tens of billions and billions of dollars or euros to Ukraine without ever questioning how that money is being spent. Oh, and it's gotten worse. Merz is now announcing a planned increase in the size of Germany's army. He wants to make Germany's army bigger again. How? He's going to institute what amounts to a draft. He's going to do away with Germany's volunteer army and replace it with a forced conscription by 2027. I mean, he's actually preparing young Germans for war with Russia. I mean, how crazy does that sound? You know how crazy? So crazy, in fact, that it sent the German chancellor's approval ratings from 29% to 29%. Months ago, this guy was at 43%, right? Then he went to 35%, right? Then he went to, now he's at 29%. I mean, the fact is, the more that he pushes to continue the war, I know we've got those differently there. Instead of saying what his ratings are, we're saying how many people like him or don't like him. Anyway, you get the picture. His feelings in Ukraine, the more that he threatens war with Russia, the more his own citizens turn on him. And conversely, the more his opponents gain ground. Look at this headline. Look at this headline. This is the AFD, which happens to be against Merz's pro-war proposals, like sending more and more German taxpayer dollars to Ukraine. They're now Germany's most popular party, quote, as Chancellor Merz's approval plummets. In fact, it appears that if an election were held today, Merz's party and its affiliates would go down to defeat. So let's see, I ask once again, how's that hate thing going? In France, Macron's approval ratings are embarrassing. The Germans, with an economy at historic lows, they're eating their own. Hungary and Slovakia, they're members of NATO and the EU, but they're standing up to both. And now this, the Czech Republic has joined the nonconformists. Look at what's happening there. That is Andrej Babiš. He is pro-Trump. He is against sending more money to Ukraine. And like Hungary and Slovakia, he's all about economic nationalism for his citizens. In other words, keep the money at home. As of last night, he's also the new prime minister of the Czech Republic. Uh-oh. Let's just say this is not a good day for Zelensky. It is not a good day for Ursula von der Leyen. And in the end, it's not a good day for hate. In fact, let's examine this question once again, since this is kind of our theme today, right? The question of what happens when you hate? Who do you destroy, or who does it destroy? Look at the EU. Its members are turning against it as it becomes engulfed in a scandalous corruption probe. What about the Zelensky government? Well, think about it. 3 years ago, it passed up on a peace deal offered by Russia where it would have kept most of its territory. It would have maintained its neutrality, and it would have maintained its sovereignty. But because of its hatred for Russia, not everybody's, of course, but the top leaders, it turned the deal down. It has lost now the Donbas, all or parts of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Luhansk, obviously Crimea, and there are signs, a lot of people are saying this, they could lose Odessa next, leaving it as a little marginalized, landlocked country. By the way, you know what else Ukraine has lost? You know what else Ukraine has lost? America. Here's Donald Trump last night.
Which country right now is in the stronger negotiating position?
Well, there can be no question about it. It's Russia.
Is Zelensky responsible for the stalled progress, or what's going on there?
Well, he's got to read the proposal. He hadn't written to his top people. They liked it. But they said he hasn't read it yet. I think he should find time to read it. If they don't read agreements, potential agreements, you know, it's not easy with Russia because Russia has the upper hand. And they always did. They're much bigger. They're much stronger in that sense. They're using war not to hold an election. But I would think the Ukrainian people would, you know, should have that choice. They haven't had an election in a long time. You know, they talk about a democracy, but it gets to a point where it's not a democracy anymore. But long before Putin, it was an understanding that Ukraine would not be going into NATO. This was long before Putin, in all fairness.
Wow. Joining us now is Bradley Blankenship, American journalist, columnist, and political commentator. Long time based in the Czech Republic, which is why he's here, by golly. Bradley, thanks so much for joining us, my friend.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me.
So great to see you. I was really taken aback when I saw this situation. You know, I spoke with the foreign minister of Hungary, and then it seemed like all of a sudden it became official that the Czech Republic seems to be moving more in line toward like Slovakia and Hungary. Countries in Europe who are looking at the EU and saying, you guys are taking us in the wrong direction. Do you see the Czech Republic aligning itself that way with this new leader, Babiš?
Well, you know, historically, the Czech Republic has been part of the Visegrad Four with Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland. They've had, you know, before recently, before the invasion of Ukraine, they met regularly and have strategic conversations for a long time. So, of course, they're talking about reviving this group. And, of course, Babiš, you know, he's a bit of a political chameleon, let's say. You know, of course, he's going to capitalize on this as a populist. I'm very interested, though, about his position, because in the first Trump administration, he had many spars with Trump, especially Mike Pompeo, when he was the Secretary of State. They had a sparring match over a nuclear deal. There was going to be an expansion of the Dukovany nuclear plant, and there was a Russian company and a Chinese company in this public tender. Pompeo had told him, we want you to sign with an American company and try to get him to sign an MOU. They refused. And there was a huge fallout between the Trump administration and Babiš at that point. So I'm actually quite surprised to see them, it appears, to be forming another alliance again.
Well, you may have just explained why Pompeo is not a part of this administration. In fact, Pompeo was a bit of a joke toward the end of the Trump administration. He's a neoconservative amongst perhaps one of the worst neoconservatives. There's not a war that guy doesn't like. Pompeo, I'm talking about. So this is a different Trump. Right. I mean, if I guess what I'm saying is if Babiš likes this Trump but didn't get along with the other Trump, it's because there were more neocons and, you know, globalists in the first Trump term than there are in this term. You get my drift?
I understand what you're saying. You know, for me personally, I think what really shocked me about this new national security strategy was that it appeared to me that the United States is going fully in a fanaticist direction, because what they're saying in this document, in many different respects, you know, not only just with Europe, but also with China, it has pretty much no bearing to material reality. I mean, they talk about that the United States' greatest strength is its openness and, you know, adherence to the rule of law. And with everything going on in our country right now, Rick, I just don't understand what they're talking about. And for people in Central Europe to try to hitch their future on this United States, this iteration of the United States, I really don't understand it. You know, I think that what is happening now, it is the ideological exhaustion of neoliberalism as we understood it, you know, with the fall of the Soviet Union. Fukuyama said we're at the end of history. Here we are. It's the end of history.
I like where you're going, Bradley. I like where you're going. I think this is a good conversation for you and I to have. And I think our viewers are going to enjoy this, because you're the second guest I've had, I think, just in the last 3 days that's mentioned this. And I read this 33-page report as well. And I understand your point, but I'm taking a different perspective on this, because when it's, you know, it almost seems, Bradley, like everybody who reads this, it's like, what was that famous passage about the Chinese proverb about the guys who look at the elephant? One guy looks at the trunk and feels the trunk. Or the blind guy feels a trunk and says, this is a tree. And the other one feels the leg and says, it's something else. And they're all coming away with a different perspective of the very same thing. No one can tell it's an elephant because they haven't looked at it in its entirety. So let me argue with you this way. What I like about this plan, right, is that it talks about transactionalism. In other words, the United States will judge countries based on what those countries have to offer the United States and what the United States can offer them. It's about deal making. I kind of like deal making. I think people should, I believe in meritocracies, for example. Now, I agree, it's not the same standard with all different countries, but I like what they're doing, for example, in the polar south countries that no American administration has ever done before, even to recognize them.
Well, I think that a lot of what's happening with Washington, you know, they're talking about making, let's just take the tariff deals, for example. All of this is totally arbitrary. I mean, how did they even come up with these numbers, you know, with the tariffs? Where I'm at here in Beijing, when they were doing the tariff war with China, it was just ridiculous. It got to a point where China's like, okay, it's pointless to even continue this anymore because it's not going to make any material difference. It is purely sparring. What is happening?
I agree. I agree with your point there that you just made, but please continue. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I think what's really happening here with NATO is the United States is simply a brain dead regime. It is just flailing. It has no strategy. And when I read this document, I know you said this is a good point. Many people take, you know, what they're going to take from this document. But what I took personally, you know, with the work that I'm doing in the United States now, I just saw them telling themselves what they feel they need to tell themselves, but what is not actually existing in the world today. The United States today does not have a functioning legal system. The United States today does not have, it really doesn't have any industrial base. You know, it's sitting here talking about builders are going to make the future. What did they have to offer? You know what I mean? I just don't see it. So if I'm Babish and I'm someone in Europe, I'm a European diplomat or a security expert, I'm thinking about European strategic autonomy. And I mean that in a very serious sense. When I lived in Europe, I talked about this all the time. I ended up being on a Ukrainian blacklist talking about these same topics, which I found ridiculous because now everything I said is coming to fruition.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, you know, a peace deal in Ukraine, obviously, you know, this shouldn't have been going on for 3 years. All of the recession that was going to happen, it was already predicted. And yet you were called a propagandist for pointing out what their own economic ministry said publicly.
But here's what here's what we come back to, Bradley. And maybe I can work this way now that we're having this pseudo-intellectual argument, which I'm enjoying. I agree with you. There's a lot to find fault with this Trump administration. And inconsistency is certainly one of them, because we can point to Venezuela, we can certainly point to Gaza and many other things. But here's my point. When you compare it to the Biden administration, when you compare it in many ways to the Obama administration, there seems to be at least some kind of genuine curiosity that is coming out of this White House, which is at least from time to time appropriately pushing back on some globalist neoconservative thought processes. I never saw that with those other guys. Do you agree with that?
I definitely agree with that. But I think what has really been happening to the United States, especially since the 90s, is just regime continuity. They're in too deep. They got to keep doing things. And if you change it too quick, the regime collapses. And my personal opinion about the United States is that we're seeing the collapse. Like, this is ongoing. It's happening. In fact, in many ways, you can say it already happened. It's just the public hasn't caught up yet. You know, I think for me personally, seeing that document and see what's happening between the U.S. and Europe, that's all I'm seeing. I think that's the main takeaway here. I know that's a pretty bold claim, but that's kind of where I'm at with everything. When I see Babish and all these European leaders in Central Europe, I understand there's some imagination here. There's a course correction, because what's been happening in Europe the past couple of years is absolutely ridiculous. This should never have happened. In fact, Stoltenberg in his recent memoir said that they didn't even have a plan for when the first Trump administration came into power, which is strategic malpractice of the highest magnitude. They didn't even know. And when Biden came back into power, they thought everything was just going to go back. You know what I mean? Like history doesn't move forward. There's not going to be more things happening in the future that you need to adapt to. So for me, when I see this entire ideological split, when I see Elon Musk talking about the, you know, to split up the European Union, and U.S. senators talking about, you know, basically attacking the EU's integrity, again, I just see this as the ideological exhaustion of neoliberalism. And so I think what's going to be happening in the future is serious discussions need to be had about strategic autonomy. In fact, Emmanuel Macron was just in Beijing. He had a state visit, met with Xi Jinping, and they talked about values and global governance. In fact, the Chinese just put forward a global governance initiative. It appears to me, I don't, it's not that I have any information about this, but it appears to me, as somebody who studied Chinese politics, that they're preparing for what I'm talking about. So again, if I'm, you know, somebody in Central Europe, I would be diversifying, not going to any particular bloc, but simply thinking about, okay, like, we got to address the reality of the situation.
Well, but what guys like, I think, Babis, you know more than me about the Czech Republic, but if they're following the course correction being applied by Fico and by the Hungarians, for example, I think what they're trying to say is we need to be nationalists economically. We need to look out for the welfare of our people. And if we allow ourselves to be led by von der Leyen and Kaja Kallas and Rutte and these people who are running Europe, they will not make decisions for the good of our people. So we're going to push back against those SOBs. That's kind of what I hear them saying. Yeah. And my sense, Bradley, is they're right.
I think that in many ways they are right. And in fact, I'll tell you an example that I saw very clearly after COVID was that in the Czech Republic, when I lived there, the government of Babiš did a very, very good job of containing the virus up front. And yet, even though that was the case, because other countries couldn't get their house in order, there was still a recession in the Czech Republic. Because when I lived there, the economy was dependent on, for example, Germans consuming products made in the, and assembled in the Czech Republic. So the integrated market, we had an issue there with the single EU market is that some countries with different levels of development and taking their own national strategies, other countries that, you know, had their own dependencies and so on, suffered in any case. And you saw with COVID, the rollout there, certain countries hoarding resources. It showed that there really wasn't a lot of equality in terms of priorities in the European Union. You know, some countries like Germany and France, for example, took precedent over Southern Europe. And so I think that that's definitely true. There's a lot of inequality in the European Union, the way it's set up. I talked to many Czech bureaucrats, for example, that told me that out of the old communist bureaucracy, the state bureaucracy that's there today in the European Union, that by far the European Union is the worst and most complicated.
Really?
So that's
Back up. You had people tell you who lived under both systems that they would almost trade in this system for the old Soviet system.
Yeah, that's right. I talked to several people who work for the EU bureaucracy in Prague.
That's surprising, obviously, because the Soviet system was not good, obviously. But I guess this system, many people argue, could possibly be, you know, even worse. I'm trying to get a sense of why these things happen. You probably heard my monologue, and I'm an American like you, and you have more experience understanding Europe than I do. I honeymooned there, et cetera, et cetera. And my son just got married in Italy, and it was wonderful visiting there. But I'm not an expert on Europe by any stretch of the imagination, but I am taken aback by the hatred toward Russia. Where can you help me understand this, by the way, just in general?
You know, when I lived there, when the invasion of Ukraine happened, I had some friends that were Russian. I won't say where the people worked, but I had some good friends there, and they experienced immediate retaliation. In fact, one of my friends, a little Russian kid at school, he was getting harassed by some Czechs. And it appeared to me, I'll be honest with you, that a lot of this hatred against Russians, especially in the former Soviet bloc countries, is just pent-up aggression from that era. Hmm. You know, a lot of people are still very angry about what happened during those regimes. And even though
so it's historic. I just kind of tell you because I want to make people understand what you just said. Yeah. My wife and I just spent some time in Turkey and I played some golf. And, you know, when you play golf, you meet people from all over the world. And I met a lot of people from the Czech Republic and from all these different countries in Europe. And I shared with them that I'm in Moscow and I'm doing some journalistic projects and I'm working here and I would do some stuff for RT and blah, blah, blah. They immediately started telling me why they didn't like Russia. So I asked them, why don't you like Russia? And you're right, Bradley. Every one of them to a person told me nothing about today and everything about the past. And I was like, wow, you're living in the 1970s and 80s, dude? Really? Well,
one thing that I found interesting, I studied this when I lived there, a lot of the polling, and I talked to people, obviously, and it was very clear that the people who actually lived under the Eastern Bloc totalitarian system were much more sympathetic to Russian people than the people who weren't around then and who had grown up in the new system. So it appeared to me that the education systems in these countries was very nationalistic and was very hostile to Russia. And there were, you know, there was a lot, there, like when I lived there, there was this whole information war about history, about the history of World War II in particular, which I found very disturbing. You know, we had the statue to Marshal Konev, the guy who liberated most of Eastern Europe during the Second World War. And during COVID in Prague, they tore that statue down, and it was a huge scandal at the time. You know, and I just found it so unnecessary. Like, what is the point? It
sounds hateful. Why? Well, here's what I found out as I was preparing for this interview with you. I just, you know, did your usual ChatGPT, and then I asked ChatGPT to pull me all the recent studies and all the recent polls. And what I see is a trend, particularly in the Czech Republic, where when the Ukraine war started, the hatred of Russia spiked. There were just as many people, and they were, anti-Russia. We got to help Ukraine. Those poor people have been attacked. Since then, it started to go in the other direction. Now it's almost like a 40-60, according to what I saw in terms of polling, where most people are like, you know what? If we can help Ukraine, that'd be nice, but we don't need to send them more money and certainly not more weapons. And if they win, okay. If they don't, we don't care anymore. It's almost like the whole thing is flipped. Most people in the Czech Republic, according to my research, they're either don't care anymore or they're actually a little more anti-Ukraine these days. Am I reading that right?
That you're really hitting on something there, because I'll tell you, even before the war happened, there was obviously a lot of people from Ukraine in the Czech Republic, even before that, including many laborers and stuff. And I would always just, and this is purely anecdotally, of course, you're right about the polls. They are accurate. But just anecdotally, I mean, I heard people say just really disgusting things about Ukrainians before the war. And then when the war happened, they were like, oh, yeah, we support the Ukrainians. They're our friends. And I was really taken aback by that, you know.
Well, how much of this?
Right.
How much of this is? Here's my thinking, and you can confirm it for me because you live there and you saw this. Seems to me that after NATO started doing this land grab of all of these countries that used to be part of the Warsaw Pact, and they started the expansion toward the border of Russia, most recently with Ukraine, which was what most people say provoked Russia into this situation that we have now. But when they started getting those countries, part of their mandate was not just make those countries part of NATO, but to make those countries anti-Russia. That they pushed the Russia phobia ideology into those countries. Now you're saying some of that was already there, and they didn't need to do that. How much of it was historic, and how much of it was added by these NATO and EU folks?
Well, you know, I think that the reformation of the education system in the 1990s obviously played a massive role, but that I would also imagine that came through the opening up of the archives of some of the regime files locally, you know, which also happened in Russia, of course. It's obviously a lot of, historical stuff, people having the historical enmity toward Russia. It has to do with education, of course. And when I lived there, I will tell you, the media, man, like the Western media, they loved it. They egged it on. And
anti-Russia stuff, you mean?
Oh, man. There was one story about, it was like a Russian, alleged Russian spy at the embassy. And they said that, like the mayor of Prague at the time, Zdeněk Štěp, he said something about Russia. And they said that this guy brought ricin to poison him. I'm like, this is like Breaking Bad or something, you know? And if he would have came, like they apparently had the intelligence, the Czech National Security State had the intelligence, knew he was coming, did not search him to get the evidence of this claim. And it circulated through the investigative press, I imagine probably from the Americans, though I don't know. And it went like wildfire. So this guy ended up having to leave. I mean, they had to provide security for him, and then he got deported and he was persona non grata. But then, like, the thing they said was rice, and I was like, this is like Hollywood, you know?
Yeah, when it comes, if your story is one that fits their ideology, they don't check the facts and they report it and put it on the front page. If it's something that doesn't fit, that does fit their ideology or doesn't fit the ideology, pardon me, then they bury it or, you know, don't report it at all. I mean, that's kind of, that's how they manufacture consent. But speaking of education, something happened recently that made me think of this education thing. You know Kaya Kallas. She's the top diplomat in the EU. She has an Estonian education. A good one, I imagine, because she's a banker. Her father was a famous politician. You would think she has a real good education, but I guess she comes from the Estonian public school system or something. And she recently said that she did not know that Russia or China had anything to do with defeating the Nazis, more or less. Now, that's a really stupid thing to say, even if you don't like Russia. And she's got an Estonian education, right? She's a contemporary post-NATO person who grew up in Estonia. If everybody else got the kind of education she did, then NATO did go in there and try and convince these people to be ignorantly anti-Russia. It's okay to be anti-Russia. You could be anti-everything. But if you're ignorantly anti-something, you're just ignorant.
Right. There was many people, when I lived in Europe, and I was targeted, like, just being a columnist and everything when I lived there for saying things that were just true. You know, and it happened like a lot. I think it was right after the invasion of Ukraine, and there was a protest outside of the Russian embassy. And I had gotten information from the people who worked there that actually somebody tried to break in and like burn it down earlier in the day. Hmm. I tweeted something about this, and a lot of my Czech friends, including some people in the media, were very angry because like this was a peaceful protest. And I had to remind people that, you know, the Russian embassy is there 24 hours a day. And just because your protest is peaceful doesn't mean that there wasn't like a attempted terrorist attack a few hours before. People really jumped the gun on this stuff, you know, and you're right. The education system is the polls really reflect this. You know what I mean? If you talk to people who lived under communism in Eastern Europe, they have much less enmity towards the Russians and other people in Eastern Europe than the people who were actually, like you said, born under NATO. And again, I would, this is pure speculation, but I think the media really has the biggest thing to play here. And you're really onto something there about the history, the fight over the history of World War II. I mean, that is like probably in the world today, that is the main ideological driver of the divide, I would say, in Europe. Because like even before the 1990s, pretty much everybody knew that the Soviet Union had won the European theater of World War II.
Yeah.
And you see over the years that just changed. Like Private Ryan came out, all these American movies. And for example, in the Czech Republic, there's an annual parade in Pilsen where the Americans came in and liberated the western half or the western like third of the country. They never say anything about what Russia did. And that was before the war. And that was before all of the diplomatic sparring and stuff. People just got beef and they've had it for a while. And, you know, this wanting to settle historical scores, it just leads people nowhere. I mean, look. Me and you as Americans, Rick, like we know this. Our country, you know, America's not perfect, but we have never been into this like magnanimous violence. And like when we drove the British out, we didn't just go ransack Britain and like, you know, take revenge. As people in America, we until recently have not been like that. And it's actually led to much more political stability than Europe has enjoyed. But there, it's like you said, a cycle of violence. And they always have this going.
I actually get the sense, and I know you're in China now, you're not in the United States, but I get the sense that there's something changing in our country right now. I get a sense that there's a little bit of an awakening in terms of globalism, or should I say anti-globalism, that people are, this is the first time in my life, and I've lived a long life in my country, that I've heard people be against sending money to Israel and against sending more money to Ukraine and against sending more money to Egypt and all these other places where we've seen this expansionism. Americans usually didn't even know where their money was going, but now they're actually talking about this. I think it's a good thing.
I think it is too, for the most part. I mean, you know, the one thing I would push back a little bit is that we really, I mean, the American system, since the fall of the Soviet Union, we have been propping up the world order. It has been to our detriment, surely, but we have been doing that because there was a lot of, it's true that there was a lot of failing regimes around the world that were, you know, threat to everybody. Our adventurous wars have absolutely shattered public support for our military. I find that our military is totally demoralized.
Yeah.
I don't think we can win any type of war, frankly. We have no discipline now, not in our diplomatic corps, not in our law enforcement, not in military, nothing. And I think that what you were seeing, by the way, about anti-globalism and people not wanting to support Israel and Ukraine, it's more of like the downstream effect of that to the public. Why are we going to sit here and support things that have never worked out?
Right.
This liberal nationalism about the universalism, like, okay, guys, we're going to teach everybody to be like us. It's never worked. Never has worked. I just read the U.S. Army, their 2006 coin manual, the counterinsurgency manual that Petraeus and Mattis helped develop. And it's, you know, actually, I'll be honest with you, it's a really, really coherent state legitimacy theory, and it's very interesting to understand America's worldview at that time. And in fact, they even had, I didn't know this, international human rights lawyer help write it. And it sounds really great, but it never worked.
Yeah, Petraeus is not like a human being. So what happens now, Bradley? Give me your take, and based on your experience, I'm starting to wonder if there's a shift taking place in Europe, and Central Europe in particular. We mentioned Slovakia, we mentioned Hungary, and now the Czech Republic. You saw what's going on with the AfD in Germany, because Merz looks like he's becoming like a real pro-war guy. You see what's going on in France as well. And we've seen pushback in Italy. We've seen pushback, huge pushback, with protests in Italy and Spain. And we're getting the same kind of thing, or a sense of it, at least, in the UK. So where is this taking us, do you think? What is Europe going to evolve into with people pushing back against NATO and the EU so outwardly these days?
The most likely thing, I mean, this isn't what I want to happen, but the most likely thing is probably both for the US and for the EU is fragmentation. That's what I think it's going to be, most likely. And I say that because in the US, you can already see California and Washington and Oregon pulling away, doing their own foreign policy. There was people from Hawaii, Congress people from Hawaii's legislature, going to Guangzhou this year, you know, talking to Chinese farm experts about agriculture in Hawaii. Those three states in the West Coast have pulled off. They're not even listening to Kennedy and HHS anymore about vaccines. You know, they're doing their own thing. This is classic fragmentation. And the EU, if they're going to follow the US as it appears they will politically, it's going to be the same thing for the EU.
Well, how much do you... What about the fact that it's the EU? The Americans are telling the EU, we think you're weak, we think you're impotent, and we don't even want to associate with you anymore. What does that do?
I mean, it's just pure projection.
Projection? You don't believe it?
I'll be honest with you, I think it's just pure projection. I think that they are masking the fact that they're weak. And, you know, this is what regimes do in their late phase. They project... They use fantasy in place of reality. And I think that's what we're seeing. And I think that's why the point I'm trying to make on this program here is that if Europe is going to follow that direction, that's not a winning direction, because fanaticism always loses. Bertrand Russell talked about this very brilliantly in the 20th century. Every regime that follows fanaticism, doesn't follow the facts, follows fantasies, always loses every time. History is very clear.
Let's end with this. You mentioned breaking up. If Europe breaks up in what form? Do you have any sense of who will go
probably
first?
Just national states.
Say again?
National states, as before. Just nation states.
Well, when I had this conversation yesterday with the foreign minister of Hungary, because we were talking about the fact that the U.S. experiment of federalism, where everything is under one umbrella, but states retain some of their rights, works in many ways because there is an ideology, at least to the United States, and they all tend to speak the same language. But when you look at Europe, they're all different countries with different borders, with different histories. They've been at war with each other. Obviously, they're culturally different. How the hell do you put all this together and try and create one big block? Right? I don't think it's been, it may have been a good idea at some point, but I can't see this working.
Well, I think you're really onto something there. I mean, in the United States, we already don't have a shared reality. We are talking in two different languages, Republicans and Democrats,
true,
and other people. But in Europe, yeah, you're right. It's definitely a lot worse. And they have, and because of both major world wars started there, it's a much more dangerous situation. So I think people in Europe really have to have serious conversations to figure this one out, you know, hopefully without bloodshed and hopefully without bringing everybody else in the world into it. And that's why I will maintain strategic autonomy, peace, conversations, you know, stopping the race hatred against Russians and everybody else.
Yeah.
It's being sane, using reason, dialogue. That's it. The same thing we need in America.
Yeah. From your word to God's ears. I mean, you're absolutely right. I don't think there's anyone in the world that doesn't, well, there are some people who may not necessarily go for that. But I think most of us who are sane and believe that we should take care of each other as human beings, believe that that's the very thing that should happen. Unfortunately, it's a lot easier to say than to do. And that's where we're coming to a problem. I do believe that this situation in Ukraine is close to resolving itself. Unfortunately, it's nasty, it's hard, it's bloody, but it's probably going to be resolving itself. And I do believe, and maybe you'll disagree with me on this.
You're probably right.
I do believe that NATO played a very heavy hand in provoking this whole thing, and it wasn't for the good of Ukraine. I think it was for their own purposes. Do you agree?
I think you're absolutely right about that. And I said several years ago, and was read by policymakers in Europe when I said that NATO was having an existential crisis. That was before Ukraine. That was in 2021. And they were talking about expanding to the east, to contain China. Can you imagine the North Atlantic Treaty Organization expanding to China? Why? You
know what I mean?
So it's pure, that was all pure imperial overreach. And now we're seeing the effects coming back home.
Yeah.
It's very simple. Thank you.
Thank you, Bradley. Enjoyed the conversation, my friend. I think we hit on a couple of very important things that are trends. We'll see if they become actuality. But in the meantime, we'll be watching. Look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Hey, let's go to our mailbag and see what kind of things you guys are saying. We're going to begin with Peter Milne. He says, you know, the Hungarian foreign minister conversation, Peter Szijjártó, fantastic guest. And he is only one of maybe four foreign ministers in this world that deserve recognition and applause for their work and their focus. You know what? I liked him, too. I thought he was good. I thought he was moral. I thought he was smart. Frank Varga has also liked it. He says, excellent interview with an intelligent foreign minister, Rick. Mainstream media should hide in shame. Well, I used to work at those places, as you well know, and yeah, they should hide in shame. Next, Aliona comments on Germany and Hungary's policies and how they differ in terms with the Russian energy imports. She says, what a stupid question about the Germans. They're still living under occupation. I don't know. I thought it was a good question myself. And Svetlana says, she comments on the Hungarian FM feeling sorry for other EU foreign ministers who can't speak against crazy initiatives like he does, like Szijjártó does, right? He did say that. And Svetlana doesn't feel sorry for those poor foreign ministers who cannot speak out like he did. They're in a position to serve their people, not a few. You're absolutely right. But they don't, because they have other interests that are judging or controlling them. Thanks so much for your comments, by the way. Thanks for being with us. You can watch me on YouTube. The channel's called Journalistically Speaking, and so many of you go there and comment, and I appreciate that, and I read what you have to say. Also on X, where many people comment, and not all are so nice, but it's okay. I'm a big boy, and I can take it. That's at Rick Sanchez TV, by the way, on Twitter, or X, or whatever the hell they call it these days. Thank you for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time.